everybody, and welcome back to Paddock Project. I have a very special guest with me today, Luke Smith, or Luke, maybe I should call you Luca Ferrari from now on. people will get that once they read the book, but Luke is an F1 journalist for The Athletic and the author of an incredible new F1 book, On the Grid, Life Behind the Scenes of Formula One. Luke, you take quite a unique angle to this book, and you've given us some incredible behind the scenes insights for so many different people and things that aren't necessarily on our screens every day. And I cracked up reading the book. I think your Kermit the Frog socks on a Monaco yacht will live rent-free in my head forever.
Uh-huh. Oh, it's rent-free in mine as well, don't worry.
I also cried, I think, seeing Charles Leclerc's text to you, and then, of course, your inclusion of Paddock Project in the book, just both of those things made me shed a tear, and everything in between. So the book has it all. And it's also clear to me from my one data point at the F175 Live Media Center that you are just an incredibly respected member of the paddock, incredibly respected by other teams, other journalists. And your questions, I think, have been so thoughtful and balanced and fair. And I always love reading your work. It's probably one of the first places I go to get a sense of what's actually going on. So kudos to you for everything.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I think one thing I wanted to start with is the last line of your bio says that Luke does not have a driver's license, but am I wrong in saying that that is no longer accurate?
No, that is correct. Yeah, I thank you. It's been the greatest irony of my entire Formula One journalism career that I've been judging people's driving for a living and have not been able to drive myself legally. But it was kind of one of those things that I lived in London for so long and I just got the tube and stuff and I didn't really need a car. And then I moved out of London to be close to family a couple of years ago. And I was like, right, got to get my license now. And finally got it over the line, which is great. So very, very happy about that. But we did, it was really just a conversation with the publisher in the US. Like, we just went out for lunch one day and I mentioned the fact I didn't have a driver's license, and she was cracking up laughing at that and was like, we've got to get that in the book somehow. So in the end, we settled on it being part of the bio. Then when I got my test date through, I was like, well, shoot, like, I might actually have my license by the time the book comes out in the United States. So this might factually not be true anymore. So I maybe gonna have to go around and sort of scribble out the line in the books, but it's a nice little anecdote, definitely.
Yes, it was true when you wrote the book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At the time of writing, it was 100% accurate and true. So I'll go with that.
Do you think about driving differently now that you have your own license, but the fact that you have been, you know, commenting on people's driving for so long, are you thinking about hitting the apex just right?
Stuff like that. I had my examiner for my test was actually an F1 fan, so I was chatting to her a little bit. And at the end, when she was like, oh, congratulations, you've passed and all of that, she was like, oh, don't go driving like an F1 driver now. And I was like, oh, don't worry. So it's just a nice little thing to have ticked off, really. And like the IOU list of people who've given me lifts over the years and like I've got a ride with, there's a lot of payback coming. I know that. So I'm going to be, I think, very popular among some of my friends in the next couple of years.
I love it. I love it. Well, talk to me about your Formula One origin story. What made you choose to dedicate your life to this crazy circus?
Yeah, I think it really goes back to when I was a child. Like, I think for a lot of people, you just get into the sport that way. I was a huge sports fan as a kid. I loved soccer was my main interest to begin with. And then I kind of stumbled across Formula One one day watching on TV. And I was at home with my mum, and my mum said to me, oh, I used to be a big Formula One fan when I was younger. And she would go to the British Grand Prix every single year and things like that. And it kind of rekindled her love for the sport as well, which was really, really nice. And that was kind of something that we shared a lot. And as anyone who does read the book knows, I talk about my mum quite openly. And she was a really big influence on my life. So I think that was a really great thing to be able to sort of share at that young age and share together. And I always knew that I enjoyed like writing in English, and when someone said to me the idea that you could be a sports journalist, I found it incredible to think that, hey, like, you could be paid to go and watch sports and just talk about it. That, to me, blew my mind. So it was, it kind of snowballed from there, really. And when I was still at school, I set up a small blog website just to write about Formula One, basically, and a lot of trial and error. And I was, 16, 17 years old, and I was just writing. And to me, at that point, it was really just a hobby. Like, it was no thought of this is already a serious career. It was that far down the line, maybe it could be something that similar to you with Padlet Project. It kind of starts as something very small and then snowballs into something incredible. And then about a year after I started doing that, I got an email out of the blue from someone who worked for NBC Sports in the US, and they were getting the broadcast rights for F1 in the United States. So they said, look, we're getting the TV rights. We need some writers for our website. Would you be interested? I was 17 years old, so I [S2] Wow. [S1] Really did not know a lot. Yeah, I was super young. It just kind of went from there, really. And it was strange, like being when I was at college doing my history degree, I was kind of doing that, but then I was also working as a journalist on the side. So it's kind of like this weird double life thing going on. But that's kind of where it all started. It was a lot of mistakes and stuff, as everyone makes when they start out doing anything, very, very young, maybe too young, but I'm grateful kind of for every step that's kind of got me on the journey to where I am now.
That's incredible. Do you ever go back and read your old blog posts from when you
were... No, I would dread to do that. Like, even when I find an article like that I might have written maybe 5 years ago that I'm citing, I kind of look at it, I'm like, oh, I would have done that differently and that differently. And I'm sure another 5 years from now, I'll do the exact same thing. So I do think, like, you know, those cringe moments where, like, middle of the night, you'd be like, oh, that thing I did 15 years ago, why did I do that? Occasionally happens, but for the most part, no, very, very grateful for all that happened. Like, a lot of trial and error, but this is the way to learn.
Well, especially when you're in a profession where everything lives kind of forever and is memorialized.
Yeah. There's always going to be a mark somewhere. Yeah. And it's such as the internet.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that is an incredible origin story. And so you became a journalist, and then I don't want to skip over the journalist years. We'll definitely get to some of that, but I want to talk a little bit about the book. You know, there are lots of F1 books out there, but yours is incredibly unique and special, and I think a lot of that is because of the behind-the-scenes angle that you take. How did you choose what angle to take on this book? What was the origin story of the book, and kind of what makes it different from others out there?
Well, it really started just from conversations with my editor at HarperCollins and my agent in the US, who my editor kindly put me in touch with. And Gretchen and Allison, they were just phenomenal right the way through this entire process. And it was strange, because a lot of F1 books coming out at the moment, and a lot of them do start with, here's an idea, let's take it to a publisher. Whereas the publisher found me and said, can you give us an idea? So it kind of went in reverse, basically. But what I've always enjoyed through my journalism career, when I was writing previously Autosport, and then when I joined The Athletic, was always trying to write these more sort of impactful pieces. Like, I don't want to just say, oh, it was this guy winning this race on this date, and here's how he won the race because of his tire strategy and everything. And I know that sporting side is very important. Obviously, there's a huge place for that. But for me, like, I've always wanted kind of a bit more purpose to some of my work. So I think when the idea of writing a book came together, I was like, well, how about I just try and write a whole book of those really purposeful articles, of those really meaningful things. And we kind of talked about the idea of, hey, it's F1's 75th anniversary. Like, where is F1 at in its 75th year? Where has it come from? Where is it going? And I think that was kind of where the book started. Like, I wanted it to be something that had this real purpose and hopefully does stand the test of time, and that in another 50 years someone could pick it up and say, hey, this is what F1 was like in 2025. Look how much it's changed, look how much it's progressed. So that was kind of the thinking behind it. Like, I didn't want it to be just a biography or anything like that. There are some phenomenal books out there that do that, but for me, I think I just wanted to do something a little bit different, and something that kind of spoke to the kind of things that I cared about anyway when I was writing. So to put that together for a book like this has been a real, real privilege.
Yeah, it's a beautiful time capsule of sorts, which is
yeah, so I like cool. that.
Yeah. That's amazing. So You traveled to how many races? I think you said in the book somewhere that one of the seasons was about 120,000 miles of flying.
Yeah, it's normally around that. It's about 11 days on planes, and that's without the time at the airport beforehand and afterwards and getting to the airport. And I don't really want to work out the full numbers because I probably wouldn't like them. But yeah, it's a lot of miles, and I normally do about 20 races a year, which is... Again, that sounds incredible, but also that comes with a lot of sacrifice as well. And yeah, a lot of time on planes.
Yes, it's not always as glamorous as it may seem, I'm sure. But talk to me about your process as a journalist. I know you said with the book, it was a little bit of, you know, kind of discovery. The publishers came to you and you figured out what to write. How is being a journalist at races similar or different from that? Like, how much do you go in with a pre-planned sense of what you're going to write and stories you're going to cover, or how reactionary is it depending on the race?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, really. I think that when you're writing a book, you kind of already got the ideas in mind in terms of what you're going to be writing about. So, for example, like there's a chapter I know we're going to talk about sustainability. And it was like, okay, I knew the interviews I wanted to get and the people I wanted to speak to and the questions I wanted to ask. And that kind of goes for all of the topics that come through in the book, because they're not so sensitive to like a race result or something like that. Whereas I think when you're going in with a more journalist mindset, it is kind of like, okay, what are the big stories at the moment? Who are the important people in terms of what's in the news? Like, what happened at the last race? What is possibly going to happen this weekend? So like, yeah, going to Australia next weekend, for example, Lewis Hamilton and Ferrari, his first race, that is the story. Like, that's going to be such a huge storyline. So you are kind of going in with that already in mind in terms of what people want to, I guess, read about. But there is also that reactionary side as well. It is that, yeah, if you have a race where in Austria last year, for example, with 5 laps to go, Max and Lando crash into each other, that becomes a story. You drop everything. Like, I literally had everything ready to go, and I was like, oh, okay, another easy Max win. And then that happens, and you're like, right, I've got to run down to the media pen, talk to these drivers, find out what happened. And you kind of need to be on your toes to be able to do that, because if you hem yourself in a bit too much, it's quite tricky. So it's a really interesting balance, and it's kind of been quite fun being able to sort of do both sides of it in that way, I guess, because I love that kind of like news hunting and like reacting to a moment and doing the best work you can around it. But it's also been really cool to do something where you can kind of take that step back and say, right, I don't need to write something immediately. You can give it a bit of the fullness of time to write something.
Yeah. What are your deadlines or turnarounds like for an F1 weekend? Are you like, I got to have something out by this time every single weekend?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, we'll normally do like post-race, I'll normally do a big like feature on the big talking point after the race. And that always goes up on Sunday night. So that will be a case of post-race, go and talk to the drivers, talk to some team principals, go back to the media center, write the piece. And then it's like, come on, as soon as you can get it out, you get it out. So it is quite tight. And obviously, if news happens, you've got to really, really jump on that as well. Whereas with a book, yeah, you are kind of saying, right, I've got the time to say, hey, I can go and talk to far more people and get a far deeper understanding, rather than just saying, okay, I need to do something in 2 hours because that's all the time I've got.
Yeah. And how do you balance those two things? I mean, when you're covering 20 plus races a season and having to kind of churn out all of this content and analysis and insight, how are you then also writing a book? Like, how have you been able to balance both of those things? It seems incredibly difficult.
Yeah, it was a lot of work, I can't lie. And I did kind of liken it to having two jobs in a little bit of a way. But I think the beauty was it kind of both complemented each other, in terms of that if I'm at a Formula One race doing the normal sort of journalism side of things, there's going to be stuff that I'll pick up for the book as well. And there's going to be things and insights that I can slip in there. So they kind of balance together quite well. And I think it was really just a case of being quite smart with my time as well. Like, knowing like, okay, I've got this deadline for this chapter on this date, therefore let's get stuff ready in advance. And a lot of late nights. I remember last year, for example, I went to Sydney in Australia for the very first time after the race in Melbourne, and I was so excited, but I'd fallen behind on some of my book work. So I basically had to give up a day of sightseeing to get on with the book. And I was like, it's a shame in a way, but also I know how important this project was, and you kind of balance it. But it's been really cool just to kind of like have those two things spinning at the same time. And then when you kind of get your hands on the final copy of the book, you're like, wow, that was all so worth it. And it's it really makes it very special.
Okay, well, let's dive into the specifics of the book. I have the table of contents up with me. I want to read the titles of the chapters, not to spoil anything, but just to give listeners a sense of the beauty. So you have Introduction, The Grid, just a beautiful description of that moment, but when everything kind of all comes together before lights go out. Chapter 1, Smoke and Mirrors. Chapter 2, The Billionaire Boys Club. I love that. Chapter 3, Off the Grid. Chapter 4, Champagne Problems. I think what maybe listeners don't know is Luke is a Taylor Swift fan. So
that was a little nod there. I did get a message when I put out the table of contents, someone being like, oh, like, what's the thinking behind that that chapter title? And I was like, it's a little Easter egg. So yeah.
Very Swiftian of you. Chapter 5, Our Deadly Passion, Our Terrible Joy. Chapter 6, Track Runner. Chapter 7, Fantastic Fans. Chapter 8, Stick to Sports. Chapter 9, The Race for Change. And chapter 10, Checkered Flag. So of all of these chapters, Luke, and I'm sure it's kind of like choosing your favorite child, but what was the most fun to write? What did you most enjoy writing?
Ooh, yeah, that is tricky. I think the third chapter, Off the Grid, that was a really special one for me. I think that when I kind of thought about what I wanted this book to be, that kind of the ideas that are in there really did encapsulate a lot of it. And that was basically looking how F1 has impacted the wider world and how it's made kind of the world a bit of a better place. So there were two main case studies I did for that chapter. The first one was with a bakery in Melbourne called Loon, which does, according to the New York Times, the world's best croissants. And the backstory to it is that the founder of Loon is an ex-F1 engineer who basically took her mindset of aerodynamics and how do you make a Formula One car quicker and applied it to a croissant. Like if you put in an extra 5 grams of flour, or if you put it in the oven for an extra 5 seconds or whatever, like that kind of constant improvement and constant way to try and make something better. I found out about that a couple of years before I started writing the book, and it really, really struck a chord with me in terms of like, wow, how can you sort of take this thinking and make it something from F1 and turn it into something so different? So to be able to talk about that was great. And then on the other side, a bit more serious, was when COVID-19 hit, and just how F1 engineering, F1 resources were used to fight COVID-19 and to help make ventilators and things like that so that it could help save lives. And it was also a little bit of a personal link in that, because it was my alma mater, my university, University College London, that actually worked with Mercedes on making these CPAP machines. So I was kind of able to like tie in some of my old roots at my university there. And that was quite a nice little sort of like hat tip to, somewhere where I spent 3 years and really, really enjoyed my time there. And I remember at the time, again, when that happened, writing about it and thinking like, oh, this is such a cool thing. And it's so close to home, and it shows how F1 is so much more than a sport. It can actually have a good impact on the wider world. So again, to be able to write about that was really, really cool. So it is definitely like picking my favorite child, but I think that's probably my favorite chapter in terms of what I wanted this book to be.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. It's not something I feel like I've read or seen anywhere else. And I think it's just so insightful. And people talk so much about how mainly in like the automotive space, how F1 technology can be helpful for like the wider world, or whether that's sustainability or just kind of technology trickling out into road cars or whatever. But you don't think about it in other industries or in other places as much. And I think it's such a unique take on how Formula One can better the broader world. I want to talk about the track runner chapter, because you run every Formula One track,
yes.
Regardless of whether there's a supercar auction happening in the middle of it.
Yes.
What's your favorite track to run, and which is absolute hell for you?
Ooh, I think probably my favorite is Spa. I think that it's just such a, it's kind of hell in a little bit of a way, because you've got to run up Eau Rouge and you get to the top and your legs are just screaming at you because it's so steep, and it's such a long circuit as well. And you kind of get three quarters of the way around the lap and realize you've still got to go quite a bit uphill as well through the final sector. But it is just like you're running around such an iconic racetrack in the middle of the Ardennes Forest. Like, that's such a cool thing to be able to do. And I think there's something that, when I started doing the track runs, like, I kind of took for granted in terms of like, oh, it's a nice little way to end the day or offset some of the beers you'll go out for later or something like that. But then like fans would message me and be like, oh, how can I do this? Like, this is amazing. And I'm like, well, you can't. Like, and it kind of dawned on me then, like, what a privilege it is to be able to do that. So that was, again, a really fun chapter to be able to write and just talk about all these track runs and like how these circuits come together and kind of like my experience of running them a little bit. And then probably the most hellish track, I think it's maybe somewhere like Jeddah, just because of the humidity. Like, it's like you're drinking soup the whole way around. Miami's quite bad for that as well. And then Singapore is actually pretty tough for it as well. And I had the year just gone, actually, I was training for the Chicago Marathon. So I had to run two laps of the circuit, and the humidity was just building and building and building. And it was like, I couldn't breathe. And then we had this massive thunderstorm, like one of the worst storms I've ever seen. I got absolutely soaked through my skin, because I was like the furthest point away from the pit straight, basically, when that hit. And I was like, well, I've just got to keep running. But I actually went quicker because I was so much cooler and I was able to breathe and things like that. And I walked back into the media center absolutely soaked to my skin. And all the other journalists had like just stayed put, because they were like, well, we're not going to try and leave while it's raining so much. And one of them looked at me and went, oh my God, Luke, like, are you okay? And I was like, I'm fine. And then everyone started clapping, just in a, like, I think as a joke to begin with, but then was like, that was a really, really nice moment of just like, oh, thanks, guys. Yeah, so you get all kinds of circuits and all kinds of things happen, but it's, yeah, a really, really cool thing to be able to do.
Yeah, it's incredible. I've loved following that on social media. It's been fun to see. I guess, speaking of the clapping, do you feel like the circuit of journalists who are traveling to races, is it sort of like a family to a degree? Do you guys know each other incredibly well? What's that dynamic like kind of on the road with a similar cast of characters?
Yeah, it is in many ways. I think that, as with any kind of like, I guess, job or workplace, because it is kind of like a workplace, like the media center is pretty much your office. You spend a lot of time with people you may not choose to spend time with, maybe more than you would with your family, for example, but that's just the nature of work. But we have, like, I'm very fortunate in that I've built up some incredible friendships in Formula One. And I think, as a media center, yeah, we are very, very supportive. And I think that the sort of the group that I'm sort of like, I've built up within that media center and hang out with, like, we've all got each other's backs, which is really, really cool. Like, we know the pressures of the job, we know how tough it can be, we know that there's going to be the bounce of homesickness, or there's going to be the fun times, but also the not so fun times. And I think that it is really lovely, though, like, and it does, I think, add to part of the enjoyment of the job for me, is that I get it to share it with some of now my closest friends, which is a really, really cool thing. And we have a really good time. Like, it's not like we see each other in Abu Dhabi and that's it until the start of the season. Like, we'll hang out in the off season as well. So it's nice to sort of have found like my people in the sport as well. Like, cause it is it's a lot of travel and it's a lot of tough times, but there are also some amazing moments that more than make up for it. And like, I've just been talking with some friends this morning about going and playing paddle in Australia next week, because it's like, right, we've got to, all the F1 drivers do it, so we should do it as well. And it's stuff like that. But yeah, I think that it just helps keep all of us going when we're on the road. So yeah, I'm very lucky with that.
So nice.
Even if you think it's a bit overhyped, AI is suddenly everywhere, from customer service to Formula Auto racing. If it's not in your industry yet, it's coming fast. But AI needs a lot of speed and computing power, so how do you compete without costs spinning out? Time to race to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a blazing fast and secure platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, plus all your AI and machine learning workloads. OCI costs 50% less for compute and 80% less for networking. That is a lot of prize money. Thousands of businesses have already upgraded to OCI, including Vodafone, Thomas Reuters, and Suno AI. Right now, Oracle is offering to cut your current cloud bill in half if you move to OCI for new U.S. customers with minimum financial commitment. Offer ends May 31st. See if your company qualifies for this special offer at oracle.com/paddock. That's oracle.com/paddock. Could your daily routine be full of hormone disruptors? There are more than 1,000 hormone disruptors living rent-free in our environment right now, in our food, our water, the air we breathe, the clothes we wear, our skincare, and they all mess with our hormones. To combat this, we've been loving Hormone Harmony from Happy Mammoth, which contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens that help the body adapt to any stressors. With over 30,000 reviews and counting, a bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code Paddock Project at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code Paddock Project for 15% off today.
I also want to talk about your chapter on sustainability. I thought that was a really fascinating look at that and the interviews you did with Ellen Jones and some of the others kind of in and around that space in the sport. It's something we talk a lot about on this podcast for our Planet Paddock series. And I'm curious what you learned from those interviews in terms of how seriously F1 and the teams are taking sustainability efforts. And I know, you know, we have the 2030 net zero goal and all of that, but I'm curious what you learned from some of those interviews and where that might be heading.
Yeah, I think it really sort of put home to me just the amount of work that is going on by Formula One and by all of the teams. And I talked to Ali Ashpatel at Mercedes.
Love Ali.
She's fantastic. She's so, so, so cool. And she was, I was kind of asking about that kind of competitive nature that you have in Formula One, that every team is kind of trying to outdo each other. And I was like, well, with this, like, you're kind of all on the same side. So surely that kind of goes away a little bit. And she was like, well, we do, like, they'll have regular working group meetings where they'll talk through ideas and things like that. But she said there is still that little, like, Formula One mentality of, oh, we've got a really good idea and we want to be the first to bring this to the table and to do this and to kind of make that breakthrough. And I just found that amazing, that even that sort of competitive edge that you would think just stays purely on the racetrack, even something like sustainability is there. But that kind of in turn, like, just pushes everyone to be better and better, which is, I think, phenomenal. So that was really, really interesting. And I think I was just so impressed by how much they are sort of seeing it as a collaborative thing in terms of all of the teams realizing, hey, if we make a breakthrough, like, can we, okay, we'll get the kudos of being the first, but can we then spread that out to everyone else and kind of make these wider learnings that people could all sort of help and support with? And so that was really, really cool. And then it was fascinating as well to speak to Dr. Maddie Orr, a sports ecologist. She released a book last year called Warming Up, which I would strongly recommend to anyone with an interest in sustainability and the climate crisis in sports. And I think that really kind of, it was really interesting to kind of get the other side of the coin, for example, and sort of have someone saying, look, this is where Formula One is maybe going wrong in some ways. Like, she talks about the relationship F1 has with the big oil companies, and she's like, as long as it's got that, isn't that always going to pull back the sustainability efforts? And then I could take that and go to people in Formula One and say, oh, what about this? And their counterpoint is, but these are the people with the expertise that actually can help us make these breakthroughs. So it's such a fascinating topic, and there's so many interesting dynamics around it. But I think that it did kind of help teach me, and hopefully anyone who reads it as well can learn, that this is something that F1 is taking very seriously, but it is also something that is coming quicker than any of us can really be braced for. Like, races like Qatar a couple of years ago, we don't want those to become the norm. And the fact is that the climate crisis is going to make that a more likely thing in the future. So I think that was a really enjoyable chapter to write. And that was one where it kind of started out being like part of another chapter. And the more I delved into it, and the more I read and the more I wrote and spoke to people, I was like, no, this has got to be its own thing. It's been a really insightful sort of thing to dive into.
Yeah, no, I love that chapter. And you talk also about the Imola race and the flooding being, yes, that being canceled, yeah, like the first time that that's happened, that an F1 race has been canceled due to a natural disaster, which I think hopefully, to your point, those don't continue to happen and we can turn a corner, but it's coming faster, like you said, than any of us, I think, can expect. I wonder if you have a book on you, Luke, because I would love for you to read a select...
I happen to... Here is one I prepared earlier.
Yes, a select passage would be amazing from the horse's mouth.
From the horse's mouth. I feel under pressure now to pick something, but I wouldn't mind actually reading the introduction, just to kind of like put... Because the reason I really called this book On the Grid, and I talk about the grid, because that to me is the point where everything matters on an F1 weekend kind of comes together. So to be able to sort of have that as the opener, I thought was really, really good. So I'll read a bit of that. Move out of the way. I have been covering Formula One and motorsport for more than 10 years all around the world. And I still have moments where I accidentally break the golden rule. When reporting from the starting grid, stay out of the way of the cars and their crews. The mechanic who just yelled at me is part of a group of 8 men helping push through the green Aston Martin of star driver Fernando Alonso, who has just finished his warm-up laps for the Bahrain Grand Prix, the first race of the 2023 season. As each car, ready to be raced hard for the very first time, is wheeled from the rear of the grid, the sea of bodies armed with wheel guns and tyre warmers grows, completing their final preparations. In the 40 minutes before lights out, the starting grid is where you'll find anybody who is anybody in F1. Today the air is thick with sweat, engine fumes and the smell of heated tyre rubber as the sky turns orange, the sun over the Bahraini desert beginning to set. Tens of thousands of fans are already watching on, cheering for the drivers as the cars come to their starting positions. Once in place and with their helmets and headrests carefully removed, each driver hoists themselves out of their cars, dodging the throngs of camera lenses, and turns their attention to discussing their final race plans, which have been meticulously laid out with their strategists and engineers to account for every eventuality. I watch as Alonso gets out of the Aston Martin, his new car for this season, after switching teams last winter. The 2-time world champion at 41 is the oldest driver on the grid, yet he has been one of the quickest drivers all weekend. Aston Martin's team owner, billionaire Lawrence Stroll, an imposing figure with big expectations and an even bigger checkbook, is there to greet his star signee. They embrace and share a few words. They could be in for a great result today, the start of a happy marriage of driver and team. I continue to walk around the grid, the massive bodies ebbing and flowing as people go about their business. It's a patch of asphalt 15 yards wide, tucked between the wall that divides the track from the pit lane, where all the teams have their garages, and the catch fencing on the other side next to the grandstand. There's little room to get around. I watch as rival team designers carefully study one another's cars up close, and the power brokers of the sport circulate, posing for pictures with the right people, shaking hands and making pleasantries. CEOs of billion-dollar sponsors chat with sheikhs, princes, prime ministers, all closely tailed by security guards. I may not recognise some of these people, but a snap, snap, snap of camera flashes tells me they're VIPs. One by one, I watch as the drivers snake through the crowds and head back to their garages, escaping the noise for a moment of respite. There's Alonso again, the legend in the final chapter of his career. There's Lewis Hamilton, the 7-time champion and superstar whose name has transcended F1. There's Max Verstappen, the young gun who dethroned Hamilton as the current world champion. There's Oscar Piastri, the rookie who wasn't even born when Alonso started his first F1 race, and his teammate, Lando Norris, the British star hoping to take the world by storm. As I move largely unnoticed through the crowd of bodies, I spot my friend Rupert, the trainer for Carlos Sainz, and wish him good luck with a thumbs up. He smiles, but I know he can't hear me. His red headphones are tuned into the team's pre-race chatter, ensuring every final detail is addressed. What tyres are used, what visor is on Sainz's helmet. It changes depending on the weather conditions, even if the driver is wearing the right balaclava or fireproof underwear. Rupert approaches the tool-filled car next to Sainz's car, picks up a powerful handheld fan and holds it into the cockpit. Keeping it cool will make the seat more comfortable for his driver. No detail is too small. I weave my way toward the front of the grid, pulling my elbows close as I squeeze past those heading in the opposite direction. It feels like Oxford Street on Black Friday, only instead of rabid shoppers, it's the who's who of the F1 world with whom I'm jostling for space. A row of security guards holds a rope cordoning off the front of the grid, where the drivers are now rushing to line up in time for the national anthem. Lateness results in a fine, even they're not immune to a telling off. A booming voice calls on the crowd to stand, and all goes silent. The engines cut out, the chatter stops. Then a marching band springs into life as a woman in a white dress bellows out the national anthem of the Kingdom of Bahrain. When she finishes, to a rousing round of applause, necks and iPhones lurch skywards to capture the flyover. A Boeing 7879 Dreamliner belonging to Gulf Air, the title sponsor of the race and Bahrain's national airline, is flying over the starting grid, a tradition dating back almost 20 years. As it nears the first corner, the right wing pitches downward and the plane circles back over the paddock, which, as the base for all the team's activities over a race weekend, serves as the centre of F1's little universe. And then a siren at the front of the grid blares. It's 15 minutes until the race starts. Time for anyone who doesn't need to be on the grid to get off it. Most definitely, me. I head toward one of the open gates along the pit wall as people stream through, again making sure not to get in the way of the drivers who will be going for their final bathroom breaks. Most have headphones on, locked in their own little worlds. Hamilton speeds past on a push scooter, while others walk alongside their trainers, who pass final words of advice to their drivers. After crossing the pit lane, I find a small corridor leading back to the paddock, which is now eerily quiet. Walking toward the media centre, I pass Mohammed Ben Sulayem, the president of the FIA, F1's governing body, and one of the most powerful men in the sport, jumping into a golf cart along with the Crown Prince of Bahrain. Both wear pristine white thobes, traditional dress for the region. Ben Sulayem chuckles as the golf cart zooms past me to complete its journey to the other end of the paddock, barely a few hundred yards. "I'm lazy," he says. "No judgment here. I know our difference in standing." While he'll be watching the race from the FIA's hospitality suite overlooking the start line, I'll be in the media centre, typing away, noting down every moment of action from the race. I take my seat back at my desk, the adrenaline still flowing, and watch the TV cameras panning down the grid, now empty bar 20 drivers and their cars, waiting for the start lights to blink out. I've always vowed that the instant the grid stops being the best part of my race weekend, it's time to stop working in Formula One. It's where everything about the sport is distilled in one go. The sounds, the smells, the tension, the glamour, the people, the sacrifices, they all combine for only a moment. Then out go the lights on the grid. The wheels spin, the engines roar loud, the crowd even louder, and the cars speed away. But what happens on the track is only a tiny part of the story. Whether you're a seasoned fan who hasn't missed a Grand Prix in decades, or a newcomer to F1, I want to show you why this is a sport, a way of life even, like nothing else on the planet.
Wow, so good. Thank you, Luke, for reading that.
Thank you. No worries.
It's so fun to follow along. Oh.
Yeah, it's cool. It's really cool, like, just reading it back. And, like, I just remember even the first, like, draft and stuff, like, it's quite just incredible to think how far that journey has come. And I remember being, like, all of that so vividly because I knew that I was going to be writing this book when I went to that race. And I was kind of like trying to take everything down, and like I was making voice notes on my phone of like, I've just seen this, I've just seen that. And I was trying so hard to drink everything in. And yeah, to then kind of just like 2 years later, basically have it like in black and white in print is a very cool thing to be able to share.
Well, congratulations to you. A couple final rapid fire questions before we wrap up. So again, maybe hard to choose, but best or favorite interview you had for the book?
Oh, that's a very, very good question. I would probably say it was with two engineers who worked on the CPAP machines, the ventilators with Mercedes and UCL Ventura. So they ironically, so they worked with Mercedes at the time. They're both now with Red Bull. And it was really hard to actually try and hunt them down. And one of them, Professor Tim Baker, was at UCL. And I finally got in touch with him, and he was like, "You've not been able to find me because I'm no longer at UCL. I'm at Red Bull." And I was like, "Whoa." It was very strange, but yeah, that was really cool. And the emotion with which they spoke about it. And I remember a couple of people said to me, like, they're real, like, engineering people, engineering minds. So to actually kind of get the feeling from them and the emotion that was involved in that project, that was really powerful. So yeah, that really stood out to me. As it was a kind of interview we'd done where afterwards I needed like 5 minutes just to kind of go away and think, okay, and really understand what we just talked about. So yeah, that stands out for me.
I love that. Favorite race, if you had to choose?
Oh, I think it would probably be the Australian Grand Prix in Melbourne. I think anyone who reads chapter 3 will get my love note to Melbourne in there. I can't tell you how excited I am. It's the opening race of this season as well. Like that's where F1 should be going for the opening round. Yeah, so I think Melbourne, like it's a pretty good track, but then you throw in the city, the atmosphere, the fans, the croissants as well. Like it's just a very, very special place to me. So yeah, the Australian Grand Prix for me.
My goal is to go for 2026. So fingers
yes.
crossed.
Oh, honestly, you'd have the best time. It is just, yeah, it's so good.
So relatedly, besides the best croissant in the world, what is your favorite kind of hidden gem on the road? Whether that's a restaurant, a bar, a museum, like any other hidden gems?
I'm getting quite good now at like starring places on Google, like so that I know that when I go back to like Bahrain, for example, I've got all of these recommendations of places I've been to. So like there's an excellent Mexican restaurant not far from where I stay in Bahrain that every year I go to, and every year I end up taking new people to, and every year they're like, this is fantastic. So that's one. Also a very good Mexican restaurant in Melbourne near where I'm staying as well, so maybe that's my thing. But I love, like, to me that look, we're going all this way, like it's important to kind of make the most of it and see where you're going as well. So like last year, for example, in Abu Dhabi, like I took a day to like go to a couple of museums and things like that, and kind of just like dig into a bit of the history of just everything, which is really interesting. There's lots of these little things you can kind of pick up, but I think that yeah, let's go for the best Mexican food in Bahrain as being a very strange hidden gem.
Yeah, Mexican in Bahrain. That was not on my bingo card, but I love it. And finally, one prediction or hot take for the 2025 season.
Ooh,
we won't hold you to it.
Hot take or prediction. I don't know how hot a take it is, because I think a few people might say the same thing, but I'm going to say that Piastri ends up beating Norris across the course of a season. And yeah, if McLaren's in contention for the title, which you would imagine it would be, does that lead to an Oscar Piastri World Championship? Quite possibly. But yeah, I can't wait to see how that's going to pan out. I think, I'm very excited for all of that to come.
That is hot, and I love it, and I'm very yeah. excited.
I write in the book as well. There was a moment where years ago I did a video talking about Alpine, and I kind of said at the beginning of the year, oh, they're gonna have a terrible season. And then at the end of the season, when they had quite a good season, Otmar Szafnauer and Lauren Rossi from Alpine found me, and they were like, oh, we've just been watching your video. And I was like, oh,
I love that they came and found you.
Honestly, like I was so like, wow. So maybe the same thing happens with this. I don't know. But it's, hey, as we said earlier, it's on the internet. It's out there now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Luke, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for this incredible book and all of your work and dedication to the sport of Formula One. It is truly such a treat for us to read and to learn from. So such a pleasure to chat.
No, thank you, Tiki. I really appreciate it. And yeah, just everything that you do with Paddock Project, it's just such a wonderful thing. It's why I wanted to talk to you guys about it for the book. So I'm it's been a real pleasure to sort of see everything you've been doing. And it's going to be an exciting season.
Yes.